Welcome, everyone, to A Story of Us podcast presented by the Anthropology Public Outreach Program at The Ohio State University. Our guest today is Madison Elliott, who will be receiving her master's here at the end of this semester. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Cool. So to begin, could you just talk a little bit about a book or an article that you've read recently that struck you, something you found interesting or enlightening?
Yeah, I mean, as a student still enrolled in classes, I'm doing a lot of reading lately, and that's been really exciting. But I guess if I had to pick one, by Lisa Jean Moore and Mary Cosset, they wrote Buzz, Urban Beekeeping and the Power of the Bee. So they're both sociologists, and neither of them are beekeepers, but they write what they call an apiethnography.
Oh, very cool.
So they go, they're residents of New York City, and so they go around New York talking to urban beekeepers, interviewing them, and they have this real critical approach to urban beekeeping that I found really interesting because it was one of the first kind of critical pieces I'd seen that wasn't explicitly anti-honeybee, you know? So I thought that was interesting, but it was, it really, I definitely think it inspired the writing that I had done in my master's thesis, which, you know, kind of takes on a more storytelling form. And I really enjoyed the book and getting to take some stuff away from it.
That's so great. That's good that it inspired you. Awesome. Yeah. Well, cool. The next question here is really just for you to describe the master's work. So talking a little bit about what it is for our audience, how you sort of crafted the way that you did it. And how does using an anthropological framework and showing that this issue that you're tackling, this Save the Bees issue that we'll talk about a little later, as a wicked problem, contribute to broader understandings of pollinator protection more generally?
Yeah. So I'm actually going to be one of the first students to graduate from OSU with a certification in wicked science, which is really exciting. And this program, which has a lot of students in it, focuses on training students to understand problems that are complex and political. And we call those problems wicked problems. And I have been working on framing pollinator protection as a wicked problem. So there are three characteristics that make a problem wicked. You've got structural complexity, uncertainty, and conflicting stakeholder relationships. And so in terms of pollinator protection, pollinator problems are embedded in a wide range of other wicked problems like climate change and food insecurity. And so that's what we would say contributes to that structural complexity. Not to mention that they shape, like pollinator protection shapes and is shaped by larger maybe social, political, and economic structures that we're not actively acknowledging. And so, yeah, that contributes to that structural complexity. And then things like environmental or climate uncertainty are what contribute to that, you know, larger umbrella of uncertainty. We really have no way of knowing what's going to be needed in the future in terms of species diversity, both plant and insect. And so it's really difficult to make decisions that are going to, you know, drive that change in the future. So there's a lot of uncertainty there. And then as far as conflicting stakeholder interests, I mean, there's a large group of diverse stakeholders that are impacted by pollinators, and sometimes it's really difficult for them to collaborate. And a lot of times, you know, the power imbalances among these stakeholders really make it influences who's part of the conversation. And so these three things, the structural complexity, uncertainty, and conflicting stakeholder interests, are what make pollinator protection wicked. And so while they're all characteristics of pollinator protection, our current approaches don't usually address them. And so maybe we do one thing here and there or really zone in on one particular aspect of the problem, but we don't usually take this kind of broader systems perspective. And that's what I'm working on for my master's. So,
and what I found interesting too is it almost is like you zoomed in to zoom out. So you talk a lot about your own experiences.
Yeah.
Could you tell the audience a little bit about those?
Yeah. So I think something I was really kind of zoning in on while doing my writing was the kind of individualized, unique experiences that stakeholders have. And part of that is recognizing that I myself am a stakeholder and thinking about all of the things that I do or have done that contribute to my understanding of this problem. And so that's, I spend the majority of the, well, the entirety of the second chapter kind of reflecting on experiences as far back as my childhood, but mostly over a period of time where I was involved in several different pollinator, you know, projects with different stakeholder groups, and thinking about kind of the more intimate feelings and thoughts that we have during those experiences, and trying to draw connections between those and the perspective that I say I have, you know, to really understand why we think that way, or at least why I think that way. And maybe by taking that approach, I can understand other people better too. You know, that kind of conversation about our epistemologies, really.
Yeah, and that interrogation of positionality too. Mm-hmm. Really interesting.
Yeah.
So in terms of the broader sort of impetus of this, your emphasis is on this idea of the phrase save the bees, right? Or at least, you know, almost problematizing it, I guess. Maybe that might be too strong of a word, but that's how I kind of understood it. So could we talk a little bit about, or could you talk a little bit about what we're supposed to be saving them from, and what this idea of emphasizing the save the bees kind of obscures or doesn't allow room for?
Yeah. So when I say that I work with pollinators or with bees, and somebody says, oh, save the bees, am I right? You know, that is, to me, what maybe you can relate to here as being a cultural anthropologist. When I say I'm an anthropologist and somebody automatically assumes I do archaeology, you know?
Right, yeah, my Indiana Jones hat is over there in my backpack.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's one of those things where it's like, you're not like really far off, mm-hmm. and I understand why you came to that conclusion, but it is kind of a misunderstanding of exactly what I do and exactly, you know, what all the dimensions of this problem are. And so anyway, yeah, I've been grappling with this question, you know, save the bees from what? And ultimately that is part of the complexity of this problem, is that bees are faced by a wide range of challenges, you know, and they can't be narrowed down to a single cause. And you know, so you've got things like pesticide exposure, habitat degradation, and like changing climatic conditions, changing seasons. And while we can manage some of these, we can't particularly save the bees mm-hmm. from them, you know? And so I think alternatively, we should maybe be thinking about adaptive approaches to bee health that make them maybe more resilient in the face of unpredictable changes. And that's not particularly as catchy as save the bees. And
it's so, a little long, yeah.
Yeah, it is quite long. So yeah, I do kind of problematize it, but I think there's something to be said about the role that it's played in shaping our understanding of the problem and how we use it to spread awareness. And I think that's a whole interesting project in itself, kind of exploring that. But yeah, I'm curious about the futures, alternative futures that it could take on, you know.
Very cool. Yeah, thank you. So the next thing I want to talk about is when I was reading your work, I was really struck by this valorization of different types of insects, or that certain types of insects, like in these entomological projects, that some were easy to kill or shouldn't be killed for, you know, having mm-hmm. specimens and whatnot. Could you just talk a little bit about that part of it, that, you know, this emphasis by people maybe on the more beautiful or more approachable insects?
Yeah. So I think people really do go to the extremes sometimes they're talking about these kinds of things, especially when they're in the moment and you're with people who relate to you in terms of how you feel about these things. And so for me, when people are strongly opinionated, like for or against a particular insect, I get really curious about why they think that way. You know, I've met people who really hate wasps. But then I've also met people who will not shut up about how cool they are. And I've met people who make honeybees their whole personality, and people who dedicate their entire professional career to like eradicating them. You know, like you've got these extremes. And so in my experience, there's really no universal way of talking about insects. You know, everyone is going to create their sort of hierarchy mm-hmm. in their mind. And what's interesting is that when you dig into these things, it can be really informative, because it makes clear the sort of things that influence our understanding of insects. You know, like if you start thinking about, well, why does somebody think this way? You can maybe trace it back to a particular piece of writing or a particular experience. And that's where, you know, this whole Save the Bees thing comes mm-hmm. in, is because that's a campaign that has significantly shaped the way people understand the problem and the way they talk about it. And so the same is true for these extreme behaviors. You know, it could be a negative experience with a particular insect. It could be kind of an education type thing or a professionalization. I know a lot of people who are anti one, you know, insect or super pro another, and that's because of the way that their projects run and, you know, the benefits that they receive by capturing or conserving, you know, different kinds of insects. So
right, that specialization almost encourages it, right?
It does.
Or that certain insects are used for certain reasons, mm-hmm. like thinking about fruit flies and, you know, their use in genetic studies and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's another reason why it's so difficult for stakeholders in this problem to collaborate is because we do have some really extreme point of views when it comes to insects, and it could be difficult for people with conflicting points of views to agree on what the best course of action is. So, yeah.
Cool. Thank you. I wanted to pivot a little bit. So we're both teaching the same class.
Yeah.
And so we, as part of our assignments, we've had to kind of like observe each other or kind of get an understanding of, okay, how are other people teaching this class and, mm-hmm. you know, evaluating them. Everybody's doing great, by the way, including yourself. So I just wanted to have you describe for our listeners the teaching method that you use. When I observed your class, it was that round table method where you kind of went around the proverbial table. You know, it was on Zoom, but let's think of it as a table in that way. And why you find that method to be so effective, or why you have chosen to use it. I thought it worked really nicely.
Yeah. So coming into the graduate program, I was put in all of these seminars and theory courses, and that's how we did it there. You know, a small group of graduate students going around, discussing the readings, talking about the questions that we have, the ideas that we have, and that was normal in that environment, you know. And I didn't really understand why that's not how we approached things on like an undergraduate right. level. Undergraduate students are just as interested and passionate and, you know, involved in the reading as a graduate student is. So why not take on that format in that space? So I guess I was kind of replicating. But the other thing is that I work, both of the classes that I've taught now have been through Zoom. And it can be really difficult to engage students on Zoom. You know, there's none of that, you know, awkward eye contact, making people want to speak up. But so there's some benefits in that sense of, you know, having a more involved conversation in the classroom. So in my classes where we do that, like the classes that I am a student in,
yeah.
I found kind of a roundtable approach to be great, not only for discussing the content of the class, but for getting to know my peers, you know, getting to understand their perspective, to see the way that they're processing the information. And I thought it would be great for my students to have that opportunity too, especially in this Zoom environment where they're not getting to interact before and after class, like having a way for them to get to know each other in that way. But it also sparks discussion that maybe wasn't in my original lesson plan. And that's really cool too. You know, students will comment on each other's answers to the questions that I ask, and it can send us in a direction that maybe to others would seem tangential, but for me, I see it as like an important way to relate the information that we're talking about to their own lives. And so it can spark some really interesting discussions. So yeah, I found it to be beneficial, and it keeps the energy up. It helps us build a community, you know. It gives the students a voice in the discussion. It's not just me lecturing at them the whole time. And yeah, I found it to work well. And I guess a final comment on it would be, you know, for this class that we both teach, there's a lot of teaching we're doing in terms of, you know, like the anthropology curriculum, but these students are learning a lot about themselves too. And by going around and asking them to like answer a question or engage with the conversation, it makes them,
yeah,
you know, think yeah. about their role in the conversation. And yeah, it helps them feel like people in the classroom.
Yeah, using that class time for self-exploration, not yeah. just that it's in the challenges, you know, if we're talking about 2202 in this case, the class that we're both teaching, but mm-hmm. they're also getting to hear about what their peers are doing. You know, if they're not comfortable sharing that personal info, that's fine, but that they're still at some level saying, okay, this is what I've learned in class, but how does it actually apply here to my experience of the world or myself?
Yeah. And as an instructor, too, I mean, obviously, I get to engage with these students pretty heavily when it comes to grading their work. Mm-hmm. I get to read their thoughts all the time. But the way that they articulate things in person can be very different. And maybe they find it easier to do that. So giving them the opportunity to talk to us is really cool. I had a student one semester who wanted to supplement her final paper with like a video recording of her talking to me about it. And I thought that was really cool because she felt more confident in that context and she was really happy to share those ideas. And yeah.
Yeah, it's not even that it's more informal or formal. It's just like a different means of expression, mm-hmm. right? And giving students the opportunities for that, I think, is something we all can keep in mind as instructors. I definitely try to think about it, yeah. but it's hard, right? Because yeah. a lot of things are built to be written down. But like exactly how you're describing it, maybe offering opportunities for art or for spoken word mm-hmm. or just a recording of someone's voice, it's a different way of doing it.
It is. Very cool. Yeah. So when I start my classes at the beginning of the semester, I make it very clear to my students that I'm also a student. You know, like I'm taking a full class schedule just like they are. And I think that is able to be reinforced through this discussion style because I can relate to them the way their peers are. It's conversational. It's not just me asking a question and them answering. I'm responding. They're responding to me. And so having that conversation makes it to where they can maybe understand who I am mm-hmm. as the person who they're supposed to be trusting for yeah, this information. Right. And that's really great for later in the semester when students need support. Things get tough at the end of the semester. People get busy.
No doubt.
And so they know that I'm going to be patient with them because I'm in a similar position to them in terms of course load and that kind of thing. And so I've talked to some of my peers in our department about it, and a lot of them are like, no, never let them know that I'm a student. I don't want them to know. But I, for some reason, find it really comforting to like do that. It allows me to be vulnerable with them. And I think it makes them more comfortable to be vulnerable with me. And that relationship, I think, is really important, especially in a class like this, where we're talking about so much important information that really is personal for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're laying the groundwork of the tenets of cultural anthropology, but we're allowing or we're encouraging students to sort of reflect on how it affects their life mm-hmm. going through this week. We're doing like the hero's journey. So mm-hmm. this idea of, okay, how do you apply this sort of thing from fiction and religion into your own experience of the world? So it's I think doing it in such a way that power and indifferent, you know, the power and difference that's inherent in a mm-hmm. educational setting is at least a little bit diminished.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm going to sit here and challenge their point of view, at least giving them some background on me as to why I feel like I can do that or why I'm trying to do that, you know, I think is helpful.
And you totally said this already, but that ability to be trustworthy at some level.
Yeah.
But like, okay, not it's not like, oh, I have to prove myself, but it's here's why you should kind of go along with me for the journey, right?
Yeah. And that, like I said earlier about this going off on tangents and the discussion going in these different ways, by positioning myself as a student as well, like it makes it okay for us to do that. They don't feel like they're going to throw me off track mm-hmm. because I have some agenda. Like we can have a discussion that is, you know, kind of inspired in the moment, and I can ask them questions mm-hmm. too. Like sometimes that's how our conversation goes, and it's really cool. So.
Great. Thanks for sharing all that. Yeah. Appreciate it. So the last thing I wanted to ask here is just if there's anything else you'd like our listeners to know about your research, maybe if you want to sum it up or talk a little bit more about like what we should take away from this, even if we're not entomologists or as fascinated as insects as you are. But that's totally your call, however you want to approach it.
I'm definitely the crazy bug lady in our department,
that's
you
fine.
Know, and that's okay with, I'm perfectly fine with that. But yeah, I mean, I'm really excited to be kind of wrapping up this stage of my academic career, you know, and moving forward and applying these really interesting ideas to, I guess, real life, you know. So I think there's a lot of interesting things on the horizon. I'm not really sure what those are going to be. I don't have any kind of self-promotions to do right now in terms of like publications or anything, but that's because there's so much uncertainty moving forward for me right now, and I'm okay with that. But if I did have to promote anything, it would definitely be the specialization that's now available at OSU in Wicked Science. So like I said, I'm going to be one of the first few to graduate with that specialization, and I'm really excited to see where that's going moving forward. We've got a really great group of bright students and faculty who have been working really hard to develop this program and maybe watch it extend into the community and beyond. So I would definitely look into that if you're interested. I mean, if you're an OSU student, that's a specialization you can get as a graduate student and as an undergraduate. And for listeners who aren't OSU students, that it's still a group that you can get involved with. I would definitely reach out to the kind of main contacts listed on the Wicked Science webpage about getting involved, because it's been really, really interesting and really exciting to learn about all of the things people are working on in different realms that are these wicked problems, and thinking about the ways we could better train our students to be able to tackle them. So, yeah, check out Wicked Science.
Excellent. Thanks so much for the time. Thanks for listening, everybody, and have a good one.
Thanks for having me.